The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I see is more or less bracketed between history and class consciousness and the Blum thesis of 1928, has been read unfairly, partially, uncharitably, and so on and so forth. If you like, there's a standard line on Lukács, which I think comes up again and again, and it really began with Abram de Borin and Laszlo Rudas, who were both intellectuals associated with the Comintern, who were backed by Zinoviev, Belakun, so on and so forth. They initiated a standard line which has been continued to our day via Adorno, Althusser, the New Left writing in Telos, and so on. This orthodox line on Lukács consists of a few interrelated criticisms. Now, I'm obviously not going to talk about them all, but they're worth sketching out. It's said that Lukács reduces labour to the nature to the subject, or to labour, therefore denying the independent existence of nature. It's argued that his theory of reification is totalitarian, leaving no space for a human subject. It's argued that his solution to the problem of history casts the proletariat as a messiah or as a Promethean type of subject-object that can dissolve all reification into a process. And then absent of this, the standard argument goes that he substitutes the party and then ultimately the intellectual for the proletariat, which of course can't live up to the grand historic mission that he provides for it. And most people draw out, well obviously Abram de Borin and Rudas don't draw this out because this is prior to Stalinism, but most people following that say that this provides a sort of left-wing pathway towards Stalinism. That's certainly Kolakowski's argument for Lukács. Now, I think there's always been a minority report on Lukács. Probably the first big name associated with this minority report is Merleau-Ponty in his wonderful essay, Western Marxism. That charts out a much more radical democratic reading of Lukács, and I'd sort of draw on that more than any other. Lucien Goldman, however, is another person that charts out this line, and more recently, Andrew Feinberg, who's released a book, The Philosophy of Praxis, goes through a lot of these arguments. And has challenged this orthodox reading of Lukács quite systematically. There are a few other readings that have come out in the last few years that do so in different ways. At any rate, my work builds on these readings, but specifically my project has been to reconstruct Lukács's philosophy praxis from the 20s as a conceptual totality. So I think there's an internal logic to it, and I actually think this logic goes beyond what Lukács himself thought that he was doing. In a sense, I think that's an aspect of every interpretation. Interpretation always goes beyond, in some ways, the work that it's interpreting. But specifically, the structure and the logic that I see in Lukács's work from the 20s draws on Hegel's phenomenology of spirit. So in a sense, I sort of argue that Lukács's work from the 20s forms a kind of phenomenology of praxis. Now, there's a few points to this. I think this is more than just Lukács. I think if you argue that there is a resonance between Lukács, Marx, certainly early Marx, Korsch, Gramsci, and other people that work within philosophy of praxis, I think some of the conclusions from this are relevant to them. I think for Lukács's own work, to view it as a conceptual totality, which revolves around the term praxis, in which praxis is both the culmination of his theory, but the term which sheds a light on the entirety of his theory, I think that gives us a way to develop an imminent critique of Lukács. And I don't think this has been done in the literature. I think most of the critiques are external, they're hostile, they separate out aspects of his theory from other aspects of it. So I think it's part of a way to critique Lukács in a more sympathetic, but overall more totalizing way. And thirdly, there are political consequences for this. I think that Lukács's theorization of Lenin, and this has been a theme throughout the conference, different interpretations of Lenin, but I think his theorization of Lenin is unsurpassed. So I think that understanding Lukács's philosophy of praxis is a way to understand theorizations of Lenin and the October Revolution. Cool. So I'll start with a section on the concept of praxis, and then I'll talk about how the dialectic of organization bears on that. Now, as I said, I think it's possible to view certainly history and class consciousness as a kind of phenomenology of praxis. But what I mean by that is to say that the concept of praxis in its full actuality, in its full set of determinations, is the culmination of the book, but it's also an aspiration that is evident in the earliest conceptual starting points of the book. And it's a standpoint, the standpoint of praxis, from which Lukács's whole work from this period, which illuminates Lukács's work from this whole period. So the idea of praxis and the concept of praxis is really, I think, what underpins Lukács's whole work. Now, this means that the concept of praxis resists a simple or straightforward definition. I think it has to be defined in the course of a totalizing work, which also renders praxis as a process. I think the first appearance of praxis is sort of in the form of an intuition, and it's a corollary to his critique of reification and the idea of labor as species being, which I think he takes on from Marx. Insofar as reification is understood as the product of a system of alienated, rationalized, and quantified labor, I think this gives rise to a negative intuition of emancipated labor, which can ground the praxis of a communist society. So in a sense, there's a utopian intuition of praxis here. But then this intuition has to go to a more concrete level. And so I think in his discussion of history and in class struggle, his argument is that individual praxis, at most, can be an individual's commitment to a kind of collective praxis, but that the bearer of praxis in history is the working class. And so this transfers the problem of praxis onto a problem of class consciousness and politics. Now this raises another term, a more concrete determinant, and that is the imputed class consciousness of the proletariat, which is a term for which Lukács is famously criticised. But then I believe that he goes on to concretise and clarify this term in his critique of what he calls the antinomies of bourgeois thought. So here I think you see the idea of praxis sort of obtains some of its full theoretical determination. And he argues famously that the proletariat solves the problem of German idealism. This is sort of following Marx's argument, solves the problem of history as well. And that the praxis of the proletariat is that solution. But again, I think this still remains a representation or a theoretical idea of praxis. So as such, it still has or bears a utopian and theoretical attitude toward reality. It still remains an aspiration, or if you like, a kind of transcendental claim about the possibility for the of the proletariat. In order to be actualized, this theory of praxis has to translate itself into a politics of praxis. And so this is how I see the final third of Lukács' book. You know, a lot of the time people look at the central essay on the phenomenon of reification and consciousness of the proletariat, they go, oh, that's fantastic, this is a wonderful theoretical breakthrough, and then they look at the final third and they go, oh, okay, this is where he turns to Bolshevism, let's just forget that. I actually see the Bolshevism as the logical culmination of the philosophy that he develops in the middle third of the book. Actual praxis is class struggle realised at the highest level of historic possibility. Now, what we make of that, that's another question, and I'll raise some questions about this toward the end, but my argument here is that political praxis, specifically the October Revolution, is the actualisation of the concept of praxis which is present throughout Lukács' whole work from the 20s. It's the most concrete form of that concept of praxis. And so another way of putting this is that there's a broad movement in Lukács' work. It goes from sociology, so a critique of reification, to history, to theory slash philosophy, and then finally to politics, politics being the culmination. Now, as a bit of a spoiler alert, I want to reverse the sequence of these terms, in a sense. I think the terms ought to go from politics to philosophy, but that I will say a little bit more about that toward the end. I'll also discuss the interaction of theory and practice in the class struggle in the second section, in the where I talk about the dialectic of organisation. For the moment, though, I want to take a step back and talk about the dialectic of theory and practice in Lukács. Now, both of these terms are separated and abstracted as a result of the division of labour and reification. Someone like Son Rethel, I think, has drawn this out better than, certainly in more detail and more historic scope than Lukács did. But the idea is that both practice and theory are abstract and immediate on a day-to-day basis. Practices, and this can refer to any practice you like, this can refer to the practice of going to work, this can refer to basic political practices, are determined in large part outside of ourselves by structures over which we have little control, but we may comprehend. Theory, similarly, is, and I don't just refer to intellectual or academic theory, theory is similarly abstract. And so both theory and practice are successful insofar as they comprehend the real abstractions which govern society. In that sense, both of the terms might interact. You know, you might think about something before doing it, or people might have, to a greater or lesser extent, a theory of their role in society, what they do. But I think that neither of these terms fundamentally can... Well, both of these terms are separated out from the real world and from... I guess, the structures which determine our lives, precisely because those structures are reified, precisely because those structures are alienated from our control. So Lukács calls this subject position the contemplative stance. Or in other words, that's the subjective side of the objective world of reification. The contemplative stance, which I see as a subject position available to both individuals and social groups and classes, is a description of the way the subject adapts themselves to the world of reification, which Lukács also calls a second nature, a world which we take for granted, which we find given, that we adapt to. Now, the contemplative stance, despite its name, doesn't need to be resigned. I think the contemplative stance is starkly antinomic. That's the point with it. It's split fundamentally between, I guess, what you might call a subjective side and objective side, or a utopian side and a pragmatic side. So the contemplative stance is just as much the sort of manic self-actualization of a Silicon Valley CEO as it is, you know, a resigned comportment towards the world. And so there are many forms of the contemplative stance. There are many particular lifestyles or subjective orientations which I think can fit within the contemplative stance. It's basically just the immediate standpoint of the individual and social groups under capitalism. So, I think here we start to see some of the more important points about Lukács's concept of praxis. First of all, as I've said, the concept demands its own actualization and concretization. It has to be embodied in real activity, but this has to be more than just some sort of conscious doing. It has to be an activity that is both conscious, but that starts to retake and reclaim the reified social forms which determine our lives. And so for Lukács, praxis has to be the work of a collective subject. Insofar as an individual can attain to praxis, it's only through their connection with a collective subjectivity which can start to alter the laws of society. And separately, praxis emerges through the conscious overcoming of the antinomies of bourgeois thought and life, the antinomies of the contemplative stance. And I think these antinomies become more concrete, the more concretized and the more actualized the praxis about which he's speaking becomes. So, the proletariat, as Lukács is famous for arguing, is positioned to traverse the antinomies of reification by virtue of its situation at the heart of production. The essential moment of this that Lukács argues for in the section, the standpoint of the proletariat, is that the proletariat experiences quantity as quality. So a question like the length of the working day, wages, of rents, so on and so forth, are experienced by the bourgeoisie as purely quantitative questions, but the proletariat as qualitative ones. This is the essential moment in Lukács's work where labour starts to gain access to the mediations whereby it can go beyond the antinomies of the contemplative stance. Now, beyond this, there's a whole argument in Lukács about why the working class can do this, why it has the power to become a collective and totalising subject. I'm not going to go through all of those specific arguments. The main point I wish to make, though, is that Lukács conceives of this class consciousness as a process, not merely as just a state or as a theory. So in order for this, in order for the argument to be made, it has to be seen in terms of the proletariat as a subject-object in becoming. And I think one of Andrew Feinberg's real virtues is that he presents this argument very clearly. He doesn't agree with it. He thinks this is passé. He thinks this is something that stopped being true after the 1920s, which is fine. That's one point of view. But he very clearly perceives that Lukács's argument about the subject-object of history is that it's one in becoming. And so this raises the question of mediation. Class consciousness is closely tied with Lukács's concept of mediation. Now, mediations, in Lukács's opinion, exist objectively. So capitalism for him is an absolutely mediated system. Everything is connected. Politics, economics, you know, you name it. All of the antinomies exist and are objectively connected. Yet insofar as reality appears immediately, it appears without those mediations. That is, as an accumulation of natural facts. And his argument about reified thought is that it's stuck on the level of these abstractions and antinomies. Insofar as the working class subjects capitalism to practical criticism, those unconscious immediacies are brought to consciousness. A classic example would be a strike. You know, this breaks through the immediacy and the naturalism of work relations. And it can reveal the historic and contingent nature of wage labour. It can reveal the force that underpins the consent that operates in a workplace, and so on and so forth. And again, there are many more mediations through which Lukács expects the workers' movement to pass. I won't go through all of those. In some ways, you know, his is a conceptual progression. It's not a real-world description of any particular working class. So there are many paths towards radicalisation and class consciousness, or as many as there have been radical workers' movements. At any rate, the point, I think, the overall point about mediation is that ultimately it has to comprehend the social totality as a mediated whole. And so I think this raises an implicit idea about the structure of the social totality in Lukács, which is effectively similar to Gramsci's idea that the social totality is the unity of state and civil society. So praxis has to originate in the workplace, but it has to rise and culminate into politics. And I think this is how you connect Lukács's idea of Lenin's revolutionary realpolitik with his critique of reification. In other words, you could call it the primacy of politics. But the third point I wanted to make about class consciousness is about radical democracy. Now, the imputed class consciousness, that is, the role that the theorist ascribes to the working class, by virtue of its being a theory, or by virtue of its imputation, is abstract, theoretical, and insufficient to generate genuine praxis. It's a necessary stage in the dialectical progression for Lukács, and it's a necessary postulate, but without winning acceptance by a large part of the class, it remains a series of timeless principles, sort of what Merleau-Ponty would call a negative strategic hypothesis about the possible direction or vector of class struggle. The alternative to this view is to see the proletariat as an interlocutor, is to see the imputed class consciousness in the form of a party as an interlocutor with the empirical class consciousness of the class. So in other words, to see the process of formation of actual class consciousness as a dialectic between the imputed consciousness of the class and the empirical consciousness of the class. This is a much more radical democratic formation of the terms. Merleau-Ponty writes, "In the communist sense, the party is this communication, and such a conception of the party is not a corollary of Marxism, but is its very centre. The masses are never the simple means of a great politics which is worked out behind their backs. Led but not manoeuvred, the masses bring the seal of truth to the politics of the party." And so this formulation, I think, clearly avoids the imperiousness of Stalinism, of some varieties of Trotskyism, or other hyper-Leninist accounts of the interaction between party and class. And this gives way to Lukács's dialectic of organisation. So the starting point for this analysis are the forms of organisation that that are based upon relatively stable bourgeois hegemony, that is to say, the contemplative stance. So on the one hand, he raises a critique of reformism, and this is fairly straightforward, although it does build on sort of, it has a resonance with Marx's critique of Hegel and with ideas that are developed in greater concreteness in Gramsci. But the basic argument about reformist organisations is that they replicate the atomisation of reification, but at the level of politics. So they're built on an alienation of the power of their mass base by a bureaucratic structure, and this theoretically and practically replicates the logic of the system. He writes, "Members are only connected with an organisation by virtue of abstractly grasped aspects of their existence, and these abstract bonds are objectivised as rights and duties." So this is not genuine collectivity, this is not genuine solidarity. Members for reformist parties in Lukács's conception exist as atomised citizens subordinate to a leadership which at best can be checked post facto. So in a sense, these parties institutionalise the hegemony of the bourgeoisie and of reification in the workers' movement. Now of course when Lukács, you know, Lukács also makes the point that within this situation there might be discussion, there might be theory, and probably Luxembourg and Kautsky are cases in point, people that had relative theoretical autonomy within the SPD but whose theories could have no real purchase on the practice of that party, or at least the moment they aspired to that they found themselves outside of the party. The second form of organisation which Lukács speaks of existing under conditions of stable reification is the sect. And this is not an organisational form that many people comment on in Lukács's work. Most people pass over his critique of the sect, and it's quite brief, so I understand why. But the sect can exist insofar as the imputed class consciousness of the proletariat is alien to the empirical class. So the sect is the possessor of the imputed class consciousness of the class, but in a theoretical and abstract form. Now, this can exist in many ways. You know, an individual theorist can be the possessor of this imputed consciousness if they like, if they've gone and read their Marx and they believe that. But insofar as it's embodied in an organisation, Lukács argues that it becomes a sect. Now, these comments on sects, they're in some parts directed at Christian sects. They also seem to refer to pre-war revolutionary sects. The De Leonites, I don't know if Lukács knew about them, but that comes to mind. His critique of sectarianism was forged in opposition to Bela Kun and what he saw as the bureaucratic sectarianism pursued by some communist parties in Europe. As they say, the politics of illusion, yet again, is very clear on this. But nevertheless, there are the building blocks of a theory of the revolutionary sect in Lukács. And the sect, despite its opposition to the Reformist Party, and usually a critique of the Reformist Party, for him equally exists within the antinomies of the contemplative stance, although it emphasises the utopian, the theoretical, and the ethical aspect of that stance. So broadly speaking, the subjective side of that stance. Lukács argues that a sect's apparent overcoming of the individualism of the contemplative stance is based on the conviction that it's the possessor of genuine class consciousness. But in this conviction, the sect reproduces the chasm between theory and practice that's characteristic of reification. And this can play out in a number of ways, as far as he's concerned. A sect might aspire to act on behalf of an unconscious working class. It might fetishize the spontaneity of that class. I mean, in the former case, Lukács argues it's a massive overestimation of its organization. In the latter, a underestimation. A more prosaic sect might find its practice reconciled with capitalism. You know, you work in a coalition with liberals to build a demonstration, but in your heart of hearts, you imagine that you're fighting for Soviets. You know, this is another form of the split between theory and practice that's quite characteristic of the left. Now, the solution to this antinomy is real history for him. It is not an abstract model of class consciousness or a more articulated theoretical model of class consciousness. Rather, Lukács argues for an approach to class consciousness which is practical, interventionist, and contemporary. And so the guide for this is the empirical consciousness of the proletariat. And this is actually another argument in favour of Lukács as a radical democrat. His whole theory of politics is based on a critique, if you like, of the imputed consciousness of the proletariat. That is to say, the revolutionary theory of an organisation is only valid insofar as it makes itself relevant to the masses, for Lukács. And so the concrete mediator between the imputed consciousness of the class and the empirical consciousness is real class struggle. And so imputed consciousness for Lukács is only as true as its assessment of the moment and its ability to relate itself to the class. And this requires both party democracy as well as open discussion between the party and its audience and the, you know, the masses that the party wishes to organise. And this is precisely why Merleau-Ponty stresses praxis as a process of communication. Now, there's an important reservation to be made here. And that's that Lukács' philosophy of praxis was articulated in an era that he described as the actuality of revolution. He goes through this quite clearly in his little book on Lenin. Now, in that book, the actuality of revolution probably exists prior to the 1905 revolution, but it doesn't close until after the October Revolution. So all of Lenin's career is shaped by the actuality of the Russian Revolution. The actuality of revolution is effectively a crisis that makes tangible and concrete the revolutionary aspirations which prior to that can only exist as a utopian anticipation. So actuality of revolution makes it possible to have a concrete and grounded discussion about the politics required for that revolution, and therefore it makes it possible to transcend the antinomy between reform and revolution, between the sect and the reformist party, so on and so forth. And so in a sense, the progress between a sect and a revolutionary party is blocked at all other points. You know, we are stuck in this antinomy. And I think this is one thing about Lukács that is relevant for the left today. And you sort of see this all over the world. You know, where revolutionaries organise, they organise in the form of a sect. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. You can be a better or worse sect. You can be a crazy sect, or you can be quite a grounded sect. You know, this is you know, a much more determinate question. Another way to put this is that in Lukács' philosophy of praxis, there are two broadly overlapping movements of history, as I see it. One you could call an objective dialectic of capitalism, in which the objective and reified laws of capitalism work themselves out. In this form, subjectivity, while it exists in impoverished, abstract, reified form. But the objective dialectic of capitalism gives rise to crisis, which creates the possibility for a subjective dialectic. And that's really what I've been talking about, the subjective dialectic being the emergence of a conscious praxis. And so praxis presupposes the at least partial breakdown of reification through crisis and through the actuality of revolution. Now, just a second, I'm going to skip a little bit. Okay, so presuming the actuality of revolution, which Lukács certainly did, he writes in light of it, A revolutionary party can start to overcome the antinomies of the contemplative stance by doing a few things. Now, I'll sketch this out abstractly first, but then I'll talk about how this is concretized in Lukács' analysis of Lenin. The first thing is that a party requires a concept of the concrete totality as the highest category. So the party has to cultivate a rich, detailed, many-sided analysis of the situation in terms of both its history and its genesis. History being the sequence of events, the relationship between a nation, its national history, international history. Again, Gramsci talks about this in more detail. And genesis being the systematic logic of the conjuncture. A party has to understand that its truth exists only in the class and in the victory of the class struggle. So a party has to have a critique of not just reformism, but what Lenin would have called communist conceit, which holds a party to be right by pure virtue of its doctrine. So the party has to actively orient toward the overcoming of its own theoreticism and abstraction. Truth is concrete. And this entails a theory of imminent change, i.e. the rejection of utopianism, and mediation becomes key. So the party has to comprehend the imminent mediations in the social totality. Lukács' model is Lenin. And so you can choose many examples of this, but probably Lenin's breakthrough in 1914 is one of the clearest. You have a clear picture of the social totality, encapsulated in his theory of imperialism, in terms of both its history and its logical genesis. This allows Lenin to develop an orientation towards what Lukács would call the key link, so the next required step in the struggle. That develops policies which can orient his party, which can help it relate to its class, et cetera, build an internationalist left, and this is all vindicated by 1917. And again, you can go into a lot more detail about that. So as Lukács writes, for Marxists, the concrete analysis of the concrete situation is not the opposite of pure theory. On the contrary, it's the culmination of all genuine theory, its consummation, and the point where it breaks into practice. So more could be said about this, but the highest point attained by this dialectic between theory and practice is expressed in the defence of history and class consciousness. And he describes it as a dialectic between moments and processes. And I think this is analogous to Gramsci's dialectic between the war of manoeuvre and the war of position. So effectively, historic processes culminate in moments of political intervention in which the imputed consciousness of the party can merge with the empirical consciousness of the proletariat to create class struggle at the highest level of historic possibility. In other words, Lenin gets a majority in the Soviets, they lead the October Revolution. That's praxis for Lukács, and that's fully actualized praxis. You know, that is the only thing which satisfies the demands that he makes of praxis. Now, I'll conclude very quickly. And in concluding, I will suggest something of a criticism of this, but it's a very sympathetic criticism. So this reading emphasises Lukács' critique of abstraction and of utopian theory. It emphasises radical democracy, his opposition to bureaucratism, the idea of praxis as the culmination of a process of education, a dialogue between party and class, an argument in which the highest truth is concrete, and that praxis is the highest truth attainable in not just theory, but in history. So this is, you know, quite a hard argument about what truth consists in. That truth is the historic actuality of praxis. This, in my mind, starts to point towards one of the limits to Lukács' theory. And I only have time to express this very schematically. But I think, in a way, Lukács' philosophy of praxis is in itself both more and less than what he makes of it or what he believes it is for itself. Or in other words, I think there's an incomplete transition from politics to philosophy in Lukács. Lukács believes that politics, actual praxis, is the high point in his work. But he was always writing his work after the praxis upon which it was based. It always came after the fact, you know, to paraphrase Hegel. You know, and what was the concrete situation? He was writing in 1923. Well, you know, the Russian Revolution's not looking healthy. The German Revolution's sure as shit not looking healthy. The communist parties of Europe are becoming bureaucratized. And so Lukács' philosophy of praxis is effectively a recollection of praxis. It's a philosophy based on praxis which has occurred. Now, I think as a recollection of praxis, this involves a certain splitting. Praxis is cast into the past and recalled as, you know, the high point of truth that has to be preserved theoretically, but then projected into the future again, if you want to maintain philosophy of praxis in this stance. There are other ways to do it, which I can talk about in the discussion if you want. And so this effectively ends up in, I think, a secular mythology. Praxis has happened, truth, the advent of truth has come, and it will come again, and that the present is experienced as a process of waiting for the truth to recur. This, unfortunately, pushes Lukács's philosophy of praxis back into all of the antinomies of bourgeois thought that he's so critical of. It relegates his philosophy of praxis to the same abstraction, the same ethicism, and the same utopianism that he criticises in bourgeois philosophy. And Lukács, I think, never becomes conscious of this. And he always holds out on history and actual praxis as the highest truth. He never accepts that what he is doing is philosophy. In other words, he is doing philosophy, and that's the significance of Lukács, but he doesn't accept that. So effectively, I think, and this is a very elliptical way to finish, I think there are two alternatives, and I think the alternatives are Adorno and Hegel. I prefer Hegel. That's it.
Okay, before we open up questions for Daniel's paper, Michael Frank will be speaking. Michael, thank you.
In one sense, my paper is for a counterpoint to Daniel's paper. And what Daniel initially said was characterizations of Lukács, I'm going to argue are basically correct. And I'm going to try to ground those characterizations more deeply than is usually done. Okay. And the title of the paper is Lukács' Theory of Reification and Marx's Analysis of Commodity Fetishism. It is often claimed that Lukács' theory of reification is an extension and creative application of Marx's analysis of commodity fetishism. Very well-known Marxist writers claim this. Paul LeBlanc, who's here at the conference, Michael Rowley, and many others. And that Lukács makes an important contribution to revolutionary theory and practice. I want to challenge this claim and show that reification, as used by Lukács, and fetishism, as analyzed by Marx, belong to entirely different problematics, and that Lukács' problematic in history and class consciousness owes more to the sociology of Zimmel, Georg Zimmel, and Max Weber, and to the objective idealism of Hegel than it does to the historical materialism of Marx. Separating out what Lukács has spliced together is made difficult by his misunderstanding and misuse of Marxist concepts, most significantly the central concept of commodity form. By commodity form, Lukács understands the form of a thing that has been overlaid and impressed upon social relations and social processes, thereby masking them. For Marx, on the other hand, the commodity form is a use value, product of labor that has an exchange value, or price. It is this value property of things produced for exchange, for sale on the market, that makes a product a commodity. Fetishism refers to this ideal, non-material, but nevertheless objective, property of the product. Marx's analysis of fetishism is coextensive with his analysis of value. Lukács' misunderstanding and misuse of the concept of commodity form is the basis for his theory of reification and for his theory of how the proletariat can break through false consciousness. In the reification essay in History and Class Consciousness, Lukács writes of, quote, the worker's compulsion to objectify himself as a commodity, end of quote. This wording should immediately give any Marxist reader pause, though it rarely does. The worker himself is not a commodity, does not objectify himself as a commodity, and does not sell himself as a commodity. That would be akin to slavery. What the worker sells and is compelled to sell because of a separation from the means of production and subsistence is his labor power, his capacity to work, which as a legal subject, he is the owner and possessor. It is labor power, not the worker himself, which is the actual commodity that is sold. Moreover, this commodity is not one that appears on the surface of society and therefore can be reflected in consciousness. Rather, it is the result of a scientific analysis, of a process of abstraction. It is one of Marx's key discoveries and part of his critique of political economy, his critique of both capitalist society and of its science. what does appear to be sold and paid for is not, is not the commodity labor power, but the worker's labor itself. The category of wages, what Marx calls the wage form, consolidates this appearance. The wage form, use an simple example of $15 per hour, gives the appearance that all labor is paid for, thereby obscuring the exploitation process and the unpaid surplus labor, which is the source of the capitalist profit. The economic categories of wages and profit form a pair. Obscuring the surplus value produced by labor allows the capitalist profit to appear as a result of the total capital invested, not just that invested in labor. Marx distinguishes between what he calls the essential relation, that is the buying and selling of labor power, the phenomenal form, or the way in which this invisible relation manifests itself on the surface of society as the buying and selling of labor itself, and ideology, the ideological reflections of equality, freedom, justice, and so forth, based on the phenomenal form, which serve to legitimize capitalist society. There's three levels in this analysis. Since the commodity that is actually sold and purchased does not manifest or show itself, it does not enter the consciousness of either the worker or the capitalist, or of the economist for that matter. Lukács' misconception that the worker himself, his person, is objectified as a commodity is the basis on which he constructs his entire argument. Let's look at this argument closely. And what follows are quotes from his from the reification essay. Lukács writes, "The quantitative," and Daniel referred to this aspect, "the quantitative differences in exploitation, that is the amount of labor time, which appear to the capitalist in the form of quantitative determinants of the object of his calculation, must appear to the worker as the decisive qualitative categories of his whole physical, mental, and moral existence. As far as labor is concerned, it becomes abundantly clear that quantification is a reified and reifying cloak spread over the true essence of the object. The increase or decrease in labor time is one of quality in its innermost nature, and although its quantitative appearance is forced on the worker by his social environment, its essence for him lies in its qualitative implications." Still quoting, "There is a dialectic between the social existence of the worker and the forms of his consciousness, which force them, that is, the forms of his consciousness, out of their pure immediacy. The worker can only become conscious of his existence in society when he becomes aware of himself as a commodity. In the commodity, the worker recognizes himself and his own relations with capital. Inasmuch as he is capable in practice of raising himself above the role of object, his consciousness is the self-consciousness of the commodity. When the worker knows himself as a commodity, his knowledge is practical. That is to say, this knowledge brings about, and this is key, an objective structural change in the object of knowledge." This is the core of Lukács' argument. That is to say, that's the end of the quotes. "That is to say, this process of reflection, of seeing through, dissolves the commodity form, the reifying cloak, and makes the worker's position in capitalist society transparent, according to Lukács, thus clearing the way, opening the door for revolutionary action. These dazzling conceptual gymnastics," sorry for that slur, "continue to seduce radical readers, searching for a way to move the class struggle forward." In Lukács' construction, we can recognize Hegel's absolute spirit, Daniel referred to this aspect, which comes to recognize itself in its objectifications. Absolute spirit has become transformed into the proletariat, which has now become the identical subject-object of Hegel's philosophy. Lukács, in his 1967 introduction to History of Class Consciousness, which is often dismissed, refers to this as quote, a purely metaphysical construct, and he's right, I believe, quote, an attempt to out-Hegel Hegel. That's how he characterized his own writing at that point. In History and Class Consciousness, Lukács gives great weight to the quantifying and calculating practices of the capitalist in the production process, a form of rationality based on reification. His methodological starting point, following Max Weber, is the immediate observable practices of the capitalist class. Society, in this framework, is constituted by a class subject, the bourgeoisie, whose practices and ideology permeate the social totality. Lukács' reification theory is grounded in the Weberian sociology of action. Marx's theory of fetishism has an entirely different foundation. Marx's methodological starting point is not the activity of a class subject, but rather social production relations, historically specific social production relations. He begins his analysis in Capital with a single commodity, whose value property he proceeds to analyze as a social form. Marx demonstrates that it is only through the mediation of value, the mediation of the value relations between the products that they bring to the market, that a social interconnection between private separated commodity producers is established, and that such a society can actually function. This is what he means when he uses the expression, quote, the reification of production relations in the third volume of Capital. Marx also uses the expression, the personification of things. By personification of things, he means that things, by virtue of their value properties, come to life, so to speak, and are subjectified in the behavior, consciousness, and motivation of human beings. As a Soviet economist Rubin put it, quote, the impact of society on the individual is carried out through the social form of things. Edmund Wilson, literary critic, wrote, things are in the saddle and ride men. I like the formulation. Reification of production relations and personification of things are ways of describing the same phenomenon from different angles. Marx uses the concept of personification again in the preface to the first edition of Capital, where he writes, quote, individuals are dealt with here only insofar as they are the personifications of economic categories, the bearers of particular class relations and interests. My standpoint, excuse me, can less than any other make the individual responsible for relations whose creature he remains. Elsewhere, the capitalist is referred to as capital personified. The concept of personification is meant to indicate that both capitalist and worker are the agents and instruments of an autonomous process, which, although it emerges from their activity, is beyond their control. Here we have the basis for Marx's theory, role theory, very different from that of sociology. The difference between Lukács' problematic, in which the form of a thing masks and conceals the actual relations that lie underneath it, and Marx's analysis, that social production relations take the form and are configured by relations between things, should be clear. I hope I made that clear. András Egedűs, actually from the Budapest School, expressed this very well. He wrote, quote, defetishization is not an act of unveiling which discloses the real world behind the world which is given to consciousness. There are not two worlds. There is no separate life world behind that which is given to fetishistic consciousness. The abolition of the fetishistic relation of man to the world is a practical act. It takes place in the practical change of the world itself, and not in the revelation of an already existing world. Fetishistic relations cannot be seen through, as there is nothing behind them. They can only be explained. And a scientific explanation does nothing to change their reality. They continue to appear and function as before. As mentioned, the relations between fragmented private producers who produce for their own account are established only by means of the value relations between their products. Changes in the value magnitudes are unforeseeable and uncontrollable by the producers, though it is their own activity that gives rise to these changes. As Marx puts it, quote, their own movement within society has for them the form of a movement made by things. And these things, far from being under their control, in fact, control them. Think of price movements, business cycles, economic crises, accelerated and decelerated waves of capital accumulation, and so forth. This reification of production relations as value relations and the autonomy these relations achieve create the need and explain the emergence of an economic science that can penetrate this opaqueness and grasp the laws of motion of capitalist society. Marx's concept of fetishism refers both to the power and effectivity that things acquire by virtue of their function in historically specific social production relations, which is not an illusion, right? And the illusion that this power springs directly from their nature as things, separate and apart from these relations. Fetishism, therefore, has two dimensions in Marx: domination and mystification. Lukács, how much left?
50.
That's fine. Fetishism has two dimensions in Marx: domination and mystification. Lukács' theory of reification has one dimension, mystification. The fetishism inherent in capitalist commodity production has given rise to two methodological errors in social science: sociologism and methodological individualism. Durkheim's sociologism, for example, grasps society as an external and coercive force vis-a-vis individuals, but universalizes this and does not understand the externality and coerciveness as the way in which specific, historically unique social relations manifest themselves and function. As opposed to Durkheim, the methodological individualism of Weber, Max Weber, eschews all collective concepts and considers only forms of individual action. Methodological individualism is made possible and plausible because the actual social nexus between dissociated individuals, that is, the exchanging of labor and labor time, does not appear as such, but takes the form of value properties and value relations of things, and of money. Nice formulation on money by Hans Georg Backhaus. Quote, money is the objectified social interdependence of isolated individuals. Also Marx in the Grundrisse, the individual carries his connection to society around with him in his pocket. Fetishism has yet another aspect, corresponding to this unique and specific form of social objectivity in capitalist society is a unique and specific form of subjectivity, a form of the historical individual. Commodity relations posit individuals as the private, egoistic, self-interested owners of alienable things. Workers, for example, are the owners and sellers of themselves as labor power. More generally, commodity relations create a merchant form of individuality. That's a quote from somebody, I forget the source. And a socially necessary indifference of such individuals toward one another. Social science has yet to work out all the cultural, psychological manifestations of money-mediated human relations. Far from society being constituted by subjects, whether individual subjects or class subjects, subjects are constituted by society, or more precisely, by social relations. All this should be sufficient to demonstrate that Lukács' theory of reification is not, as is often claimed, an extension and creative application of Marx's analysis of commodity fetishism, but that it belongs to an entirely different problematic. Let's now examine the relation between Lukács' theoretical perspective and his political practice at the time he wrote History and Class Consciousness between 1919 and 1922. And here I'll get back to Daniel's caricature, right here. Try to justify it. Revolution was an actual possibility in Germany from 1918 to 1923. In March 1921, the German Communist Party, the KPD, tried to force the process and call for an insurrection and organize dynamite attacks. There was little response, and the KPD then called for a general strike. Party members did respond, but workers in general did not. Unemployed party members were sent into the factories to drive the workers out. The upshot was an ultra-left disaster, resulting in several hundred workers killed by the police and the army, thousands arrested, and the drop in the party's membership from 400,000 to 180,000. Lukács supported the so-called March action, and even after, when the balance sheet was clear, did not repudiate it. Much later, he had a different stance. The relation between theory and practice should not be oversimplified. But the case can be made that Lukács' theoretical perspective was consistent with his voluntarist and ultra-left practice, politics. Or to use Weber's concept, that there was an elective affinity between the two. There are two aspects of Lukács' theory of reification and its overcoming that are politically relevant here. The first is the implication that seeing through the cloak of reification, dissolving the commodity form that disguises the actual social relations of capitalist society, as he formulates this, is possible at any time. Irrespective of the general state of mass consciousness, the current mood of the working class, the effects of previous struggles, the degree of organization of the class, the existence of an advanced layer of workers, the implantation of revolutionary cadres, the balance of forces, and so on and so forth, all the factors that go to make up a revolutionary situation. It is the abstraction from all of this in Lukács' approach, which I would argue is precisely what accounts for its appeal. The second aspect of Lukács' theory that makes it consistent with voluntarism and ultra-left politics is the complete absence of structure, the absence of any conception of objective, impersonal domination of the autonomy and gravitational force exercised by capitalist production relations, and the compulsions and constraints they impose on the bearers of those relations. Together, these two aspects of his theory make it compatible with ultra-left politics. Goran Therborn, some time ago, characterized the theory of the Frankfurt School as a double reduction of science and politics to ideology. The same applies to Lukács. This paper has a narrow focus, and does not deal with all the domains in which Lukács applies his concept of reification. I do not argue that none of this is of any value, but I focus on the core of his theory and argue against those who claim that it has something valuable to offer revolutionaries, that it is theoretically confused and politically disoriented. And I believe that Lukács would have agreed with this assessment.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.